Good morning. The OGs know where that little meow is because we've been using that bump video for some time because this is a regular rhythm for our church. Ha ha ha. See the little double entendre there? Rhythm. Come on. Wake up. You guys are the 9 a.m. You guys are supposed to be the ones who are into it. We are every 6 months or so, January and in September-ish, we do this thing called Vision Sunday, where we just kind of stop and we go back to basics and we remind ourselves sort of who are we as a church, who are we as a community. Vision is the idea of what's your North Star? Where are you headed towards? What mark have you set for yourself as a people that both guides your vision for the future, but then also helps you make some decisions in the present about maybe where God is moving and active. And so for us, our vision, I'll sort of give it away, is breaking barriers to encounter Jesus together. That's our North Star as a church. And that guides not only how we want to be known increasingly over time, it also guides sort of our everyday planning of what we feel like God is doing in our midst. And so today, for this time, will be a little bit of both. We will dip back into that beautiful story that our church gets its name from in John 4, the story of Jacob's well, and some things that feel especially resonant to us right now, given where we're at as a church. And then we'll end a little bit differently than we normally do. We'll end super practically by talking about some of the main things that are going on over the next 6 months or so at our church and invite you into those things. So, our church has a weird name. It's one of these cool, funky names. As I say almost every time that I explain why our name is what it is, someone came to our church once. It was actually a relative of mine, and our founding pastor got up to teach, and she leaned over, and she said, "So is that Jacob?" I'm not Jacob. Our founding pastor wasn't Jacob. Jacob's well is this Jacob in the Bible. It comes from this beautiful story. And in this story, what we see is this extraordinary encounter that Jesus has with a woman across all kinds of barriers that should have existed, that should have kept this interaction from even happening. And I won't go through all of them, but suffice to say, I feel like as we've meditated and really wrestled with this passage over time, you sort of find more barriers that should have been there as you understand the context, as you understand some of the cultural, historical things going on. So this is a Jewish man and a Samaritan woman. And at that time, in case we miss it, even in what Rachel just read, John, the author, feels like he has to tell us, like, this shouldn't be happening. You notice that in parentheses at that one point where it says, because Jews have no dealings with Samaritans. Why? Because these were ethnic groups that were at odds with each other. They were at odds with each other for religious reasons. We've been studying the Minor Prophets, talking about how God's people were carried off into exile, and it made it very difficult for God's people to remain solely to have their sole allegiance be to their own God. And so many of those people went and adopted the customs, cultures, and religious practices and worship of them. The Jewish people at that time would have understood the Samaritans to be sort of that group of people among them who had adopted these foreign practices, who had abandoned the one and true God at precisely the time where God's people needed to hold the line most. So there's historical things going on here between these people groups. And then there's just the interpersonal dynamic. She's the first one who says, whoa, why are you asking for a drink from me? Like, you're definitely not supposed to be talking to me. And if this interaction were observed, as it is at the end, I don't know if you notice that, but it's observed at the end. We get sort of our first evaluation of it from eyes that don't understand what's going on, and the disciples marvel that this is happening. They're like, yeah, this probably shouldn't be happening. As the interaction intensifies, instead of things sort of, I even use that term, intensifies, and instead of things sort of getting nicer and nicer, things, Jesus like turns up the temperature here. Because not only is there all that historic, cultural, religious kind of stuff in the air, he gets to this woman's very story, the specifics of her story. And those specifics would seem to be things that Jesus, who by the end of their interaction she's acknowledging is some sort of religious figure. She's got him down about three quarters of the way through their interaction. She's like, I think you're probably a prophet. I think you're probably a religious man because you're perceiving some things here. And given who he is and given what we learn about her, only more should we marvel that Jesus was willing to break those barriers in order to encounter this woman. Because what he says to her, eventually they have this interaction, and I'm skipping over most of it because I really want to center in on the last bit of this story, which we've never really done before. But they have this interesting interaction around living water, around the idea of there is a soul-level thirst that we all experience, and we find various ways to try and satiate that thirst. We find different pursuits as human beings that we think will fill that up. Theologians have called us to change the metaphor, kind of the God-sized hole in all of our hearts that we seek to fill with all of these various things that seem to promise that type of satisfaction. And she says, man, at first, she thinks he's talking about living water, literal water, sorry. She thinks he's talking about literal water. And she's like, where can I find this? I'd love to just turn something on and not have to do all the stuff with the well and come out here a couple times a day. So she doesn't understand that there's metaphor going on there. But Jesus eventually says, I'll tell you about this living water as soon as you go and grab your husband. And far from an innocent comment, this is Jesus putting his finger on this woman's deepest source of shame. Her deepest source. Now, we don't know why. People have speculated. She might have, she then says, I don't have a husband. And he says, yeah, I know you don't have a husband. And he says, in fact, you've had five husbands. Now, what that means culturally is a little hard to figure out. I think wrongly, most interpreters for centuries have just jumped to, oh, this is a scandalous woman. This is a woman. Probably given the cultural context, maybe more likely that she's been passed along by different men. Where I tend to land this is that I say all of our stories like this woman's is some combination of our own sin and the sin of others. And I don't think we have to put a percentage on that for her, but it's almost certainly a combination of the two. At the very least, he has put his finger on her deepest place of, the place in her that's most hidden away. The place in her that she least wants others to know her in. He goes right there. And he says, you won't have the type of soul satiation that you desire until you allow me, your only true hope, to actually speak into that part, to have access to that part of your story. And surely what we have here is a condensed conversation. We don't know what the conversation is from there forward. What we do know is that this woman experiences something profound enough that she goes bounding back into the very town that she seems to have been slinking away from. It's a little weird that she's there at high noon. That's what the sixth hour is. She's there in the hottest part of the day. She's there totally alone. Normally you go out to the well with people. Normally you go out either early or late when the well would have been cool. So from that, most interpreters say, yeah, we probably have some clue. She's probably a social outcast. She goes bounding back to the people that she seems to have been previously hiding from, and she announces this. Pam, go to that first slide. First, we have this little detail. I love John's gospel because he's just so... John was Jesus' best friend, and he was the last one to write his account of the life of Jesus. We studied John for a long, long time here. And one of the things that we learned about John is because he has decades and decades and decades to put together this account, there's just no word misplaced. There's no detail misplaced. Everything has a purpose. And as you're tired of hearing me say, hopefully those of you who've been around enough, John is always telling us what happened, and he's also asking us to consider the deeper level of what happened. So here's what happened. The woman left her water jar and went away into town and said to the people, "Come see a man who told me all that I ever did. Can this be the Christ?" I love that detail that she left her water jar. I think that John, he didn't have to say it. Why that detail, right? I think, and I would be less confident in this if we hadn't traveled with John for a year and a half before, but I think that what John is doing here is he's asking us to pause and say, she left her water jar. I think what he's saying is that she's come to understand that she has a much deeper need than even her greatest physical need. I think what he's saying that what she thought she was coming to get was far superseded by what she actually received in the presence of Jesus. I think that what he's saying is that this life-changing encounter with Jesus, where he breaks all of these barriers to get to the very heart of this woman, completely reprioritizes every aspect of her life and identity. So the woman left her water jar and went away into town and said to the people, "Come see a man who told me all that I ever did. Can this be the Christ?" They went out of the town and were coming to him. Many Samaritans from that town believed in him. Why? Because of the woman's testimony, he told me all that I ever did. I want to talk about what, just real briefly, what happened in this interaction, why it was so life-changing for this woman, and then how she welcomed others into it. So first of all, our vision here is breaking barriers to encounter Jesus together. That comes from this story. That was lifted from this. That was our attempt to, in a memorable way, summarize what happens in this story. So I've outlined many of the things that are going on in this encounter, and we would hope that we would be a people who look at the barriers that exist in a place like Central New Jersey and say, what would it look like for us to refuse to accept those as the norm insofar as they keep us from encountering Jesus together? And so that's why we have the core values that we have. We are gospel-centered. We believe that it's the story, and we'll talk about these over the next couple weeks. We're gospel-centered. We believe that that commitment comes from the story of the gospel, which is the story of God's intervention in human history, the good news of what Jesus has done for us in his death and resurrection. We're thoughtfully engaged. We believe that this then sends us out into a world full of barriers with a message that people, what you actually need, what your deepest need is, whether you realize it or not, is this Jesus, is a life-changing encounter with Jesus. We believe in life in multi-ethnic community. In a place like Central New Jersey, where there is such beautiful, amazing diversity and the best food maybe in the whole wide world collected into this random, wonderful little state of New Jersey, we say, what would it look like if instead of all moving to our corners where it's comfortable, all remaining in places that feel familiar to us, what if we broke those barriers and actually figured out what would it look like to unify around the gospel rather than secondary things as important? And that doesn't mean that we don't honor and celebrate the uniqueness of the cultures represented here. That's actually part of unity, is allowing people to be distinctly who they are and not just be this melting pot where we've all got to sort of conform to one thing. But that's hard to do. And yet we're committed to that work. We'll talk about that in a couple weeks. We have the core value of seeking justice and mercy. We believe that there is a world full of barriers that are not God's original intention for them, and that we are called to participate in bringing those barriers down in the name of Jesus and for his sake. And finally, we believe in joy and generosity in mission. And that flows from this vision, is that this is an all-hands-on-deck kind of, there's work to do in this world. There's barriers that exist in this world. As fascinating as all of those cultural, ethnic, historical, religious sort of barriers are, honestly, it's so obvious, and yet it struck me in a fresh way as I returned to this story. And by the way, I have no idea how many times I have taught on this text, and yet it is just ever fresh. This text just constantly is revealing new riches to us as a community. And this time it struck me that we talk about breaking barriers to encounter Jesus together, and we talk about the barriers between Jesus and this woman. And there's one barrier that is so obvious, and yet it just jumped off the page to me this time because I didn't see it. It's the barrier between God and humanity that is being broken through in this moment. That's the actual greatest barrier here, is that this is why the thing that we're centered on, this gospel, is good news. Because the reality of each of our stories begins with the fact that we are separated from God and without hope in this world, left to our own devices. That the barrier that most needs to come down in all of our lives is the barrier that our hearts have to relationship with God. And yet what's so beautiful in this is that we see that the initiative in breaking down that barrier is not hers. She is just going about her business. She is doing what she has done her whole life. It is God who shows up in her story, seemingly out of the blue. And yet, from the very first moments of the story, we have this clear sense that Jesus was not just going from Jerusalem up north through Samaria, but he has come from heaven's throne itself. And the wording at the beginning of this chapter, which I wish I could just have you sit here for 4 hours and show you every word of this, suggests that Jesus knew and had prepared himself for this encounter. That you could almost argue that the entire events so far in John's gospel lead up to this one woman being encountered by Jesus. And yeah, we can oversell in an overly individualistic age the idea that Jesus died for you, but let's not undersell it either. That there is a sense in which what God did was for each one of us individually. And he will find a way into our stories to encounter us. You see, what happens to this woman in this interaction is, and I'll never forget, I think this comes from Tim Keller, probably greatest influence in my teaching and pastoring, pastor in New York City who died recently, is I always think about this when I think about this woman, and I don't know if it's even where he talks about it, but he says, our deepest need is to be fully known and fully loved. And I just don't know that there's a better example of that than this encounter. Because to be fully loved but not known, oh, I love you so much, oh, you're the best, oh, you're the greatest. And to not actually be known, to be told that by someone who actually doesn't know your heart, doesn't know your life, to just be given that kind of praise is just shallow. It's shallow. And you're kind of like, yeah, if you really knew me, right? Like, if you really knew me, you maybe wouldn't have as high an opinion of me as you currently do. To be fully known and unloved, that's our greatest fear. For someone to say, now that I have full access to who you are, I don't like what I see. Right? This is why romantic rejection is such a unique kind of betrayal, because you feel like, man, there's a vulnerability there that I've shown myself to you, and that's what's been rejected. That's our greatest fear. To be fully known and fully loved, though, that is our heart's deepest desire. And I think that that's why when it comes time for this woman to give her testimony, right? What does she say? It's so interesting, right? Come see a man who's the second person of the Trinity, who is pre-existent with the Father, who came in the incarnation. It's really important that he came in a virgin birth because it means he both is and isn't part of the sinful line of humanity. He's going to die on a cross, which there's this thing called atonement that you kind of have to understand. It's substitutionary. It goes back to the Old Testament. What does she say? She's just like, come see a guy who told me all that I ever did. Is this it? Is this our Savior? Why? Because she goes, he knew it all, and I felt nothing but profound love from him. And who knows what he said to her? But by the end of it, the town is going, we now know that this is the savior of the world. I think he keys her into there's more going on than just a nice interaction. In fact, at the end, when she says one of the best parts of the interaction, she goes, oh, when the Messiah comes, he'll tell us everything. You know what Jesus says? Yeah, that's me. He says, yeah, I am. Hey, go away, me. That's me. So who knows, like, that's where the conversation, he probably goes into it a little bit more. And she goes, like I am? Like, she leaves with a sense of, he knows everything. He knows everything. If that's the only thing she left with a sense of, right? She would have just slinked away from him too. Because she probably already feels whatever's going on in the town, they know too much. They know too much, and I can barely bear it. So I come out here alone in the hottest part of the day because I can't bear being fully known and yet rejected. She goes back in town and says, he knows too. Guess who he is? And guess how he feels about me? That's her testimony. One of the things that we are going to massively lean into in this next season is we've been talking about discipleship and sort of what's next for us and what deeper encounter with Jesus looks like for all of us. And one of the things that strikes us is there's got to be, we talked about one of our strategic priorities, we'll get to this in a second, is fostering relational depth, the importance of that. And so we'll be doing that in a very specific way in these things called discipleship groups in the spring. But at the core of those, we're kind of just, there's not much else planned for these things other than we're going to share our stories with one another. And while that sounds like not much, I don't know if you've ever really sat and been able to hear multiple people's stories of how they came to faith, what God has done in their life. We've been doing this as a staff, and we know each other pretty well. There's pretty significant relational depth on our staff. And yet, the sort of storytelling that we've been doing over the last season, 6 months, it's made us tighter, which has been great. But man, it has caused us to stand in awe of Jesus together in a way that I don't know that anything else could really produce that. Because there's a sense in which we've just been saying to each other, come and see a man who told me all that I ever did. I'm pretty sure this is Jesus. I'm pretty sure this is it. And it's so profoundly encouraging and emboldening to have someone that you know and love share their story at that kind of depth and go, yeah, that's kind of what it is for me, right? Like fully known, fully loved, I've experienced that in this specific way. It's a very vulnerable thing to do, and yet we feel like that's what we're ready for as a church. And part of it is informed by the simplicity of what we watch this woman experience. The other thing that we've been talking a lot about in this season is we called it, in our strategic priorities, normalizing evangelism. That one of the things that we see modeled for us in this woman is she doesn't become a cul-de-sac of God's grace. Instead, she becomes a conduit of God's grace, right? It doesn't end there. She doesn't just camp out and say, wow, this was really great, and Jesus, when's Bible study, and I'll come on out. She feels compelled to go and share this with others. And this is just not something that we've always been strong in as a community. Is the going and telling, is the inviting others to experience what's here. And some of you do this beautifully, and some of you model this well for us, but we want that to be more the norm here. And so we're going to keep plugging away at doing that. But what I love that we see here is that the woman, again, models for us that God doesn't need us all to be theologians. He doesn't need us all to have all of our theological ducks in a row and our biblical literacy at 100 and every defense of what people could throw at us. This woman is far from a theologian. In fact, there's a little bit of doubt in what she goes back and says. It's actually phrased negatively. She says, come see a man that told me all that I ever did. surely this isn't the Christ, right? And interpreters say she might be toying with them, like, oh, it can't be, right? Or there might be genuine doubt for her. She's like, it's too good to believe. It's just too much to believe. And, like, I still got a lot of questions. She's a Samaritan woman. She's been raised, as we hear in their interaction, she's been raised with a whole different set of beliefs than Israel was expecting of Messiah. And so she's far from a theologian. You know what she is? She's a witness. And she just says, this is what I experienced. This is my story. And so we believe that what we're going to experience in those discipleship settings, sharing stories with one another, that that is the very thing that we're going to encourage you to bring out into your relationships outside of this community. And to not worry about, well, what if this question comes up? What about this? I don't think that I, what if they, you know, what if they ask about Habakkuk, right, or whatever, right? And it's like, it is still the case in all of what our whatever we are, postmodern, post-postmodern cultural moment is, for all of our foibles, and there are many, they are myriad, about what we get wrong about reality and about what human beings are and about God and all that stuff, you know what still resonates? It's story. Someone can argue with your theological belief, really hard to argue with your story. And if we really believe that Jesus is the center of our story, and we make Jesus the center of it as she does, that's still compelling. It's still compelling. Because one thing that you don't do in our modern moment is to say, I don't think that that's actually the case. I think you're just confused, right? And so we're going to encourage us to do a little bit more of, come see a man who told me all that I ever did. Could this be the Christ? Because I'm increasingly convinced that he is, right? That's so many of our stories. And I think sometimes it's interesting because I think that, as I was thinking about it this week, I was thinking about, there's really two things that I think we see in this woman in terms of why she goes and shares with others that I think are the two things that we can lack that keep us from doing the same. One is she's, the two are awe. She's in awe of God and the experience that she's had of him. And then there's somehow, given that it seems like she's a kind of social outcast, somehow she finds it in her to love the people enough to go, I think you need this too. And so I think it's awe of God and love of others at the end of the day that moves us towards sharing. And I think that sometimes, I think the first one is maybe there's a sequencing there. Is that when we return to a place of awe of what God has done, of simply who he is, of his goodness in our stories, of how unfathomable it is, right? And I'm not talking about glory stories where we just go from one great experience to another, right? Because anyone can sell that product, right? I'm talking about what she's getting at here, which is, you don't know me fully, he does. And if you knew me fully, you would find it really hard to love me fully. He does, and he loves me better than anyone else could love me, right? That's a very humble kind of story. That's a very, like, and so it's awe at God's goodness, not our own, is what she's modeling here. It's a sense of, I just can't believe how far his grace goes. And then, I think for us who have traveled a little bit, the awe becomes, we're still doing it. Because our stories don't go from one success to the next, right? I know some of you are sitting here like, I'm already done with 2025, right? Like, and we're 2 weeks into it and things haven't gone. And yet here you sit because I think that in the depths of your heart you go, I think he's the Christ. And I don't know where else that I would turn. Because there's a whole lot of his goodness and mercy and grace to me over my shoulder. And that gives me confidence that there's more ahead of me. And so right now I can still hold fast. That's its own kind of testimony. That's its own kind of, wow, who is this one? And then we say, man, if that's what I'm experiencing, if I've gotten to the place where I feel like, man, I just don't know where else I would turn for hope and for grace, who are we to withhold that? And again, not withhold a 10-part systematic theology that we just overwhelm our coworkers with, but just with a little bit of, hey, have I ever shared my story? Hey, how was your weekend, right? The classic, you know, I went to church yesterday and I found it meaningful. That's your one-liner for Monday morning. And someone says, oh, what do you mean? Oh, have I never told you that I'm a Christian? Right? No, you haven't. All right, can I give you like my 3-minute version of how I became a Christian? Sure. All of a sudden you're witnessing and you're like, what just happened? Right? Because all it was I just think that we're the ones who often up the ante. If someone, just to pause in this for 1 sec, I always think of it this way. This might be a weird way to think of it. But if I had a friend who was a really faithful Muslim, and I was like, how was your weekend? And they were like, yeah, we had this or that, you know, whatever, this observance. And I was like, please don't tell me about it. I don't want to be proselytized, right? Like, that's weirdo me. But if they said, hey, are you curious what that is, what that's about? You know, Hindu friends, what Diwali's about or whatever? I don't think I would be like, whoa, we're postmoderns. We don't share religious. I would be like, yeah, if that's part of who you are, yeah. And especially if I was in awe of it and believed this stuff and believed that it had changed my life, right? Like, why would I withhold that? And so this is what, and it's just hard. I get that. It's hard for me. I'm a pastor, right? Like, you should see these sweet people when I tell them what I do. My thing is, I'm on a golf course, I tell guys on about the 12th hole what I do, and then they apologize for every word that they've said prior to there for bad shots. And I go, and I've learned, I actually told that to a bunch of pastors, and the guy was like, oh, I that happens to me too. He's like, you know what I do? Is I say, why do you think that that's what you have to do right now? You know that like our whole religion is based on like, we're awful and we need Jesus, right? Like that's our whole thing. Not we're holy people. And so I've started doing that, and it leads to a very interesting conversation. But that's what we're trying to normalize in our church. And it's modeled so beautifully by this woman, and so simply in many ways by this woman. So let me run through some of, this is just great. Here's the last part, the very last part of the passage. So when the Samaritans came to him, they asked him to stay with them. They encounter him and they're immediately like, there's something here. There's something here. He's very compelling. And I think they have him stay because they're like, I want to go tell my friends. Right? Like maybe only the spiritually curious came out first, and then they're like, oh, this might be it. We should probably go grab some other people. And many more believed because of his word. Then I love this. They said to the woman, it is no longer because of what you said that we believe, for we have heard for ourselves, and we know that this is indeed the Savior of the world. The point is not that people would forever draft off of our stories. And that's part of our instinct. Because we go, my story is not sufficient. No, it's not. It's not sufficient to bring someone to faith. It might be sufficient to get them curious enough to actually come here. It might get them curious enough to actually open their mouths in prayer, alone, in private, what am I doing on a random Monday night. Then it's up to the very one that you're hoping that they encounter. And it's a beautiful thing, right? Kids, right? This is, teens, this is our deepest hope for you as parents, is that there would come a time where you say, it is not because of what you said, mom and dad. That was helpful, it got me there. But we now know because we've encountered him firsthand. That is our deepest hope for you, if I can just speak on your parents' behalf, right? And this is our hope for our friends, neighbors, coworkers, the people who we're at Little League games with, is that, yeah, it wouldn't be about our stories being sufficient, but maybe we were the ones who got someone in the door. The other crazy thing about sharing a bunch of stories of how people that you know came to faith is you remember, people are still going to become Christians from here forward, right? Like the amount of Christians that exist in the world didn't stop when you became a Christian. It's not going to stop now. There's people who will be here who aren't Christians right now, 3 years from now, right? Why shouldn't some of those be our neighbors and friends? Wouldn't that be cool? Some of you are those people. You're like, is this what we did? Yeah, we talked about this. We talked about you. We prayed about you. And now you sit here. And now you're part of what God's doing. Let me walk through just a couple things with our strategic priorities. So here's what the spring is going to look like. I gave most of this away. Go to that next slide for me. We'll have signups for all these things over the next number of weeks. How we do discipleship here is that on Wednesday nights, we do this thing called Discipleship Course. We could not encourage you more if you're new, that this is really the core of what we do outside of Sundays, and this is where the real lifeblood of our church is. Basically, what you do is We take you through what we call a core curriculum that kind of defines what discipleship is, provides some categories around that, provides some shared language and shared experience around what discipleship is. Takes you about a year and a half to get through those, so three semesters if you want to think of it that way, fall, spring, and then another fall or whenever you start, about three semesters. We really believe that that's a necessary introduction to discipleship because we know we're coming either from nothing, and so just having that this whole idea defined to us, given categories, given language is really important, or we're coming from all different traditions where discipleship means different things, and we feel like giving you a sense of what do we mean by it, what are we after with it, is a really important sort of entry point into our church. And so that will happen as usual this semester. Again, we'll have signups for these over the next few weeks. This semester is physical 101, so what does it mean that we're embodied beings? This is where we talk about things like sexuality, work, money, that kind of stuff. Intellectual 101 is more sort of the biblical, theological knowledge stuff. And so that will start, as you see there, on February 12th. That's a date that I get asked a lot. When is discipleship course launching? But as I said, for those of you who have been through the core curriculum, the artists formerly known as the 200 eligible folks, we are doing something pretty different. This spring, we will be doing these things called discipleship groups. These are much smaller groups. They'll still meet on Wednesday nights. We're actually going to do them every other week to just try and feel what it's like to maybe spread out the experience a little bit more. Again, they'll be very focused on us sharing stories with one another. If you are part of these, your group will be very familiar to you. We're kind of leaning into the relational sort of hubs that exist here and allowing you to sort of enjoy the fact that there's pre-existing relationships in these. There are about 10 to 14 people. They're being formed. We have a list right now, and we're trying to figure out, but we know that probably, our guess is not that there's 25 of you that haven't signed up for these, but we're aware that there might be, I don't know, 5 or 10 of you that we missed somehow when we were signing up for these first. Maybe those of you who are like graduating the core curriculum after this last semester. So we're very excited about these. Tons of questions. I know we're going to learn these together. But again, just picture 10 to 14 people. We're going to allow these to meet in homes. You can meet here if you want, but we're really hoping that this semester is a foundation for a much more relational kind of discipleship where we get to know each other enough to speak into each other's lives. And so that's a big one. That's a big change. And should be an encouragement for those of you who haven't started discipleship to get through that core curriculum so that you can be a part of these discipleship groups moving forward. Right now, the plan would be we go back to discipleship courses. We've known it, the 200 kind of deal in the fall, and then we do these in the spring. That's our working assumption right now, but we'll see. We're just going to, you guys know us, we're going to see how these go and then kind of collect that and figure out where we go from there. All right. The other kind of big thing happening in our church that you're all aware of is we've gone to two gatherings, and a lot of what we felt like we needed to focus on has to do with the downside of two gatherings is feeling like two separate churches, and so we're trying to do stuff that keeps us connected to being one church. So we talked about strengthening community, leaning into our men's and women's events, continuing to do community meals like we did the big Christmas one, community-wide events. Here's evidence of that. I just love pictures. It feels like we're about ready for some pictures. Here's a picture of, do you guys remember the community event where we did the picnic out in the park? We'll continue doing stuff like that this coming semester. Here's pictures of men's retreat. Great time. How many of you were on men's retreat? That was a wonderful time to all be together. That's Pastor Obed cheating at Wiffle Ball, all the way to the right, if you're curious. If you know, you know. We had the ladies, the ladies painting night. Molly Lynn will kill me for that picture, but that was a wonderful time that you guys had. And then who could forget when we were all together? We'll keep finding times to do this kind of stuff where we're just together as a family, even if we have to pack this place out, because that Christmas gathering was just so incredibly sweet. And then the third big priority was the normalizing evangelism. Again, right now we're really focused on, we want there to be a culture of invitation. We want the community events to be easy points of entry for our friends who maybe aren't as inclined to show up in a space like this. We've begun to see that happen, which is so beautiful. Folks who maybe wouldn't otherwise be overlapping with our church are able to be at these community events. The two gatherings was to make space, and we're seeing that happen. We are. This is a very light gathering because we have members meeting after the 11 a.m., but we are seeing evidence that that folks are coming as a result of us creating space in the two gatherings, which is very cool. And then there's going to be a very intentional teaching series in the spring on the Proverbs that we're just going to really encourage you to bring folks out to. I think it'll be practical in a way that's sort of easy entry, but also Jesus magnifying, because who else could we be? So yeah, we'll do a little bit more of that kind of stuff. I'm going to skip that next one, Pam, and just go to this. Here's your upcoming events. Here's the schedule over the next couple months. I'll just talk through this real quick. You heard about Connections Brunch already. Again, if you're new or newish, we'd love to see you at that. We're going to try it in between gatherings this time around. D-Course launches on the 12th. This is one helpful thing to know. We will all be here that Wednesday on the 12th. Because we kind of want to introduce the concept of what we're doing with discipleship groups. So if you're in the discipleship groups, you'll be here that Wednesday, and then whoever's facilitating your group will tell you where you'll be meeting and when and all that stuff. Membership Q&A, that would be the next step towards membership for some of you. Women's retreat, we do have a date for the women's retreat, so if you want to jot that down, ladies. We do have a date for the baptism bash. That'll be in May. We're doing that again. Hopefully, last year it seemed to work well that's before the students head out, and so we're going to do that earlier than we've done it in previous years so that can continue to be the case. We're going to do the next big community-wide event is we'll go to a Somerset Patriots game. That is going to be adults, as in high school and up. And so, kids, we love you, but we're going to hang out as adults at that. If you're at the men's one last, whenever that was, spring, we were just like, this is so fun. We should bring everybody. So we're going to do that. And then your care group gatherings will be in February, April, and June. That'll be the rhythm for care groups. Cool. We are a community that exists to look around and say, what are the barriers that we perceive? Right, and we perceive that there's a barrier to a deeper kind of transformative discipleship, so we're doing D groups. We look around and we say, well, there's a barrier that the two gatherings could create, and so we believe that doing more stuff where we all get to be together in community is a way to encounter Jesus together still. We look around and we see a barrier where we say, we know there are more people who need Jesus in Middlesex County and the surrounding areas. We are deeply convinced of that. And so we're going to keep calling us to be those who announce this and go out into the world like that woman did and say, I don't have much, but I do have a story, and I have a hero of that story, and it's not me. It's Jesus. So that's where we're headed in this spring. There's no better way to sort of recommit ourselves to all of this than coming to this table, than coming to Jesus and what he gave us. And so we'll come down these two aisles. There's a gluten-free option in the middle, bread on the outside. And the night before he was crucified, Jesus took bread and he said, this is my body broken for you. This is what my love, my full love for you costs me, is basically what he's saying in that moment. He said, take it in remembrance of me. Then he took wine that was at the table, and he said, this is my blood poured out. Again, the cost of that love, but also a reminder of what it means to be fully known. I'm fully known in our sin, fully known in our unworthiness, and yet made worthy by Jesus. Come and take of that with thanksgiving in that way. Scriptures are clear that this table is for followers of Jesus. If you're not a follower of Jesus, maybe make today the first day of your journey with him, the day that you encounter him in a way that changes your story from here forward. If you're not quite there yet, scriptures are clear that you honor him most by just remaining in your seat. So I'm going to invite the band back up. We're going to sing a couple more songs, and then you can come forward when you're ready. Let me pray for us.